Good evening, and welcome to Fairy Tales. I'm your smiley-faced host, Chris, here to feed you another tale of terror. Tonight, we're going to be discussing how the lines between fiction and fact blend so seamlessly when it comes to crimes and legends. Last week, we saw how the Whitechapel murders of 1888 birthed a new legend, known as Jack the Ripper. What happens, though, when the same type of sensationalism creates a more modern legend of its own? One that travels through and communicates through a series of webs and strikes when you least expect it, to the people you least expect it to happen. Join me this week as we look into a budding modern-day legend unfolding in real time. Now, grab a warm drink for this cool night. Lock the doors and check the windows. Check under the bed and settle into your favorite chair. It's time for another fairy tale. Now, before we get started with the story, I wanted to go ahead and introduce from last week and ongoing now on Fairy Tales, my co-host and the co-host of Beautiful Places to Die, Abby.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure doing this with you. Now let's get started with the story. It all started with those damn smiley face stickers. Those generic little faces with the black eyes and curved smile. Just a basic little smiley face. I wouldn't have even noticed them if someone hadn't pointed one out to me. Someone had stuck it to my briefcase, possibly while I was walking in from my car to the building. The streets of La Crosse were busy and I thought I had felt something bump into me out there. Sure enough, there was a damn sticker. Then they kept showing up. I'm not even sure how long they'd have been appearing before the first time I noticed them, but I sure as hell noticed how often I saw them. On the doors or windows of shops I frequented, on street signs I'd see on my commute. At first it would be one or two a week, really standing out to my mind. Then, they started showing up more frequently, once or twice a day now. Showing up in the mail at my house, left on my car handle for me to find in the morning. I had to start parking in the garage when the entire back windshield was covered in the damn stickers. Being a detective, I started getting more interested in finding the perpetrator of the sticker vandalism. I set up cameras in the front of my house, watching the areas I'd seen stickers appear on. I knew I'd be able to catch this bastard on film. I was even looking forward to getting another sticker. The stickers stopped appearing for a couple days after this, even away from my house. I started to feel a sense of relief that maybe seeing the cameras helped scare them off from doing this strange act. Then the faces started appearing at crime scenes. Case after case of young college men going missing, usually near a bridge over water. At every bridge, a smiley face spray painted into the bridge. More smiley faces when bodies of these same type of men were discovered along the sides of rivers or floating down them. Smiley faces everywhere again. I couldn't stop seeing them, even checking older case files, finding similar graffiti in older cases with the same victim type. My supervisor didn't listen, calling it a wild goose chase, and that these men had all fallen in due to walking home drunk. Still, the smiley faces taunted me. A point came when no more smiley faces had appeared, neither at my home nor at the crime scene. We hadn't even had a drowned college student case in general. I grew hopeful that maybe the killer had gotten bored or captured for another crime. I began to go about my life normally, trying to shake off the smiley faces and how they had plagued me for so long. It almost worked, too. Almost. Another smiley face sticker appeared. This one on a case file report for a young man who had gone missing after leaving his preferred bar. While a similar crime, he hadn't passed by any bridges, and he was older than usual victimology, so I didn't consider looking for any of the smiley faces. Yet here one was, staring me in the face, at the end of a report typed up regarding a possible sighting. The small yellow face and black eyes staring into my soul. I had torn off the piece with the sticker, throwing it away. I couldn't get it out of my mind, though. Soon enough, more stickers found their way to my house. I finally remembered to check the cameras, but found that they had been manipulated. They had damaged them enough that they stopped working years ago. I had been too distracted by the killings to check on them. Now, they were coming into my house, leaving smiley faces on my mirror, on the kitchen cabinets, on food in the fridge. I finally left amid switching hotels around the city to keep them off my trail. I think they found me again, though. I've noticed a car following me lately. I've stopped going to work, and I try not to leave my room unless absolutely necessary. Yet they're always there, ready to follow me when I do. I always lose them, but what if I can't one time? The stickers are appearing again, too. On takeout I've ordered, on the other doors of the hotels. They're everywhere again. I don't think I can escape them. I don't think I'm going to.
That was a eerily haunting tale.
Yep. I mean, I did all the research, and, you know, as we're going to talk about with fairy tales, we're going to explore a little bit more about some of the theory behind this. But for now, I guess we're going to talk about your case.
Yeah.
How much do you know about graffiti?
So much.
What do you know about graffiti?
It's made with paint,
mm-hmm,
or other materials.
Right.
And it's on buildings or other surfaces.
Uh-huh.
And it's art.
It is art. It's street art. Okay, so graffiti is, that's a pretty good definition of graffiti. It's street art typically done in secret on buildings, trains, bridges, all kinds of different stuff. There are actually about 10 different types of graffiti total that I was able to find according to a popular artist website, widewalls.ch. So first is angel, which is angel motifs, usually like cherubs and stuff like that. Angels are most relevant to helping for memoriam of somebody who passed.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Then you have king and queen, which are usually, it's just somebody who is really good at...
The boss.
Yeah, kind of the boss. If they're really good at graffiti, they'll get a title of king or queen in the streets, and a lot of their art will feature a crown or something like that with their signature.
Because they the boss.
They are the boss. Then there's the married couple, which is usually on two different surfaces, but they try to conjoin them in the art piece, usually between two buildings or maybe two train cars. So it'll go, the motif will go between both pieces.
So it's
pieces.
Not actually people.
No, these
it's
aren't.
It's just a person, that, or a piece that spans two different surfaces.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
And then there's a heaven tag, which this is a hard to reach place, usually undersides of bridges, roofs of buildings, like places you would need a rig to get up to, or a ladder or something. These are also nicknamed heaven pieces because they're so dangerous that doing it may get you into heaven.
So all the ones when you're driving through your city and you're like, how the F?
Somebody had to do it, and it was the challenge.
Go, go, gadget, graffiti.
Then there's the back-to-back, which this one is also kind of similar to the married couple. It's when a art piece goes over several buildings or pieces and kind of a big mural, whereas married couple could be kind of two different things with a similar theme. This is a continuing piece along all kinds of stuff.
Right on.
It was listed as black book, but it's more of a practice book that a lot of taggers and graffiti artists use that they do their style in, because when you do this, you're doing it undercover and you usually only have like one night to do this. So you need to make sure you know exactly what you're going to do, your strokes and all that. So this is your practice book.
One Night in the City, graffiti edition.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that would make a fun game, actually. I wonder. I mean, I think there is a game similar where you do graffiti. I don't remember what it's called
now.
I'm
not sure.
Yeah. Jet Set Revolution, maybe? Something like that. Anyway, then there's the throw up, which generally looks like, it's a whole bunch of stuff, different size, different colors, different shapes, different lines, usually tagged by a specific artist. It's just like a huge mural. And then there's the whole train, which you spray paint the whole train when what big theme, also getting a whole building. The 10th and final one is tagging. And tagging is actually the most popular type of graffiti. And this is the one you're going to see normally in any city, on park benches, on curbs. It's just a one-shot piece. Usually it's given a signature, but most times it's just when somebody wants to throw up a piece of work. So the reason we're talking about graffiti is because of the case that we're discussing tonight, and that's going to be the smiley face killer theory. Now, first we're going to talk about Patrick McNeil. So Patrick McNeil was last seen in February 1997 at the Dapper Dog in Manhattan, New York. So he was last seen alive, turning left on 90th Street. This was by a few witnesses that were able to identify him.
He was driving?
No. Sorry, he was walking. He was walking out of the bar, walking through town, and he made a left on 90th Street, according to the witnesses.
Okay.
They also reported that there was a car with possibly a man and a woman in it that was following him. They knew it was kind of following him because had been sitting there for a while, and then it finally left when he came out of the bar, and he actually stumbled and was on his hands and knees, and the car stopped and waited for him to get back up and keep moving before it started moving.
But he was stumbling.
Yeah, he was stumbling. He was very drunk, visibly drunk.
Can we just pause for a minute and let everyone know that we're actually not recording tonight in the shower? It's just really bad storms.
Yeah, there's beautiful thunderstorms going on now. Setting the ambiance. This was February 1997.
Right.
So Patrick was found drowned in the Hudson Bay 2 months later in April 1997.
Oh, dang.
50 days after he had gone missing.
Had he been in the water the whole time?
So, that's a lot of speculation here. That's part of what was brought up in the investigation here. So first off, where he was found in the bay didn't make sense because of how the currents work. So where they think he could have possibly went into the water, the currents just did not take you to that point. So that didn't make sense. He was found face up. Which most drowning victims are actually found face down. It's the kind of the natural way that if you drown, that's how you drown. So he was not found in that typical way. When they did more investigation on his body, they did find that he had ligature marks around his neck, indicating he was suffocated before being thrown into the water. He also had really, really bad burns, I believe second-degree burns, on his face, neck, and torso.
That's burns in the water?
Yeah. What they also noticed, you asked about if he was... Oh, or was he
in the water the whole time?
Okay,
days.
So that's one of the other things is during the investigation. So the medical examiner called this an accidental drowning. Years later, actually, the investigator on it was a Detective Gannon. Now, you may recognize Gannon from your case that you're going to be talking about on Beautiful Places to Die this week with Jared, but this is the first case that actually brought attention to his theory on what was going on. He didn't think that this was an accident, and he looked at the case and he investigated a few things, one of those, again, which was the time that he was found. There was not enough decomposition, especially for being in the water that whole time. 50 days in the water, you'd be very decomposed in a very specific way. So there does show evidence that he was killed and kept above water for a few days before he was dumped.
But only a few days.
They don't know how many as long, but they do know that the body spent time in death above water, out of the water.
How long do they estimate that it was in the water?
They also suspect that he was in the water for about a couple days, because there was evidence that the water did have some effect on his decomposition.
So the official state is that they don't know where he was for as much as a month or more.
Basically, that's what they're piecing together, is there was no way that he was dead the whole time from a drowning.
Right, and I know it would be cold water. You said this was February in New mm-hmm. York. So it's definitely cold, cold water, which slows down decomposition.
Yeah. They also noted that the environmental decay did not match. One side of the body was just decaying at a faster rate than the other. And that's how they learned that this was possibly because part of it was not exposed to the water and only part of it was exposed to the water. Usually a drowning victim is going to be totally submerged in water at a certain point. And then, so their body's going to kind of decay at the same rate, even if it floats back up.
Right.
So Kevin Gannon, who was the New York City detective at the time, and Anthony Duarte, as well as Dr. Lee Gilbertson, came up with a theory that first burst onto the scene in April 2008 when Gannon, Duarte, and Gilbertson held a news conference in New York City about the deaths. This was 2008, and back then there were 40 cases across 29 cities in 9 states that they thought were connected.
I actually, on Beautiful Places to Die, will cover a little bit about that press conference. It was on Good Morning America in February of 08.
They also, later on, released a textbook. Kevin Gannon and Dr. Lee Gilbertson released a book called Case Studies in Drowning Forensics, where they covered the cases in more detail and the theory, and I believe they listed about 11 to 12 young men that they thought were prime suspects for the, or not suspects, prime victims.
Actually, that book was a major reference for my episode this week.
The Smiley Face Murder Theory, or also known as the Smiley Face Murders, the Smiley Face Killings, and the Smiley Face Gang, started in, as we mentioned, 1997. So starting in that year, over 36 young men that have very similar characteristics have been pulled from rivers and lakes. The victims were mostly white, 20-something athletic males, college-age, with potential for successful futures, until they went drinking one night near bodies of water. So usually they would all be out partying with some friends, celebrating something, or just being college-age kids and having fun. They'd go to high population districts with lots of bars that also happen to be near lots of waterfront or with bridges past, on their way home. They would all be within walking distance, and most of them wouldn't be with their friends for some strange reason, and they would be walking home or heading home, and then nobody knew where they went. All of these young men fell in and drowned. That's most of what the police statements were going to be for these men, is that they all got drunk, they all went to a bridge, they were trying to pee into the water, or whatever young men do when they're drunk, and something happened where they drowned.
Maybe they saw jellyfish.
Maybe, that's possible. That is very possible. They wanted to go get some jelly from the jellyfish.
Jelly from the jellyfish tree.
So, you know, the victimology is definitely enough to start linking the cases. But that's, okay, that happens. You know, it could be, again, very, very similar circumstances.
Right, I mean, how many people died in Manhattan that right. year, or in that time span?
Exactly. But then they brought in the addition of smiley faces that were graffitied in the places where bodies were discovered, which added kind of another level of a mystery here.
Okay, I'm a little confused because you said that they're where the bodies were discovered, but they were drowned?
So some of them were washed up on shore, showing evidence that they may have drowned, but they had noticed when they went back to those areas, there were smiley faces graffitied in nearby structures. Sometimes it would be the first public structure along the river, which would be a bridge, where they possibly also fell in.
Okay. Or were pushed.
Yeah.
Thrown.
So, as we mentioned, in 1997, the first one was Patrick McNeil. There were a few more, actually a lot more, after that they started noticing, such as Chris Jenkins, who in November 2002 was found. So he went missing November 2002. He was found 4 months later floating in the Mississippi River on his back with his arms crossed. This one was classified, much like the rest, as an accidental drowning. But they went ahead and did more research on this one and found out that there were signs of a struggle, and his rate of decomposition was not far enough along for him to have been in the water for 2 months.
Wait, so his arms are crossed like he's like a vampire in a coffin?
Absolutely, yeah. That's exactly what they described it as.
We're supposed to believe that he drowned.
Yeah, and just...
Because he left his arms crossed.
And coffin posed.
He just like coffin posed in the water till he died.
Right.
Yeah, that happens.
So this was changed to a homicide in 2006. Right, they did figure that out. So this was an MO that they started realizing with this, is that the bodies were always found way too fresh, despite sometimes being missing for over a month in many cases. Some of them were less than a week. A lot of times it was a month, two, sometimes five. And it usually happened in the winter, and that was because they suspected that the killer or killers were using the fact that winter, not many people were going outside as much, especially up north, because this happened all the way from New York through Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota. Like, it's a wide range, but it's all mostly northern places in winter.
I'm so sorry, because I got totally hung up on the fact that you started out with, the problem is, the bodies are too fresh. I mean, when is that the problem?
But, you know, that's what they were finding. They also really discovered that damage to the bodies does not match how far the bodies would have had to travel from where they disappeared, where they were discovered.
Right, the, like, rough and tumble wear and tear of...
Yeah.
Waterways.
So most of the theories were that these men were taken, killed, and then dumped later on to make it look like they had fallen in and hope that nobody would notice any of the details like this. So as of 2019, according to Gannon, Gilbertson, and Duarte, there were between 100 and 250 possible victims.
That's insane.
70 of these have been connected via the smiley face graffiti and okay. other graffiti that they discovered.
Other graffiti.
We'll get into that in just a little bit. Okay. But yes, they believe that there's actually a whole system of graffiti. 30 of the men had GHB in their system. So I know you will talk about this on Beautiful Places to Die, but this is not uncommon to find in dead bodies. And I don't know what the levels of them were when they were discovered, but it was obviously enough to note if only 30 of them out of the possible 250 had noticeable GHB levels in them.
Right. And what I actually learned in investigating the death of Jared Dion is that our bodies naturally produce GHB after death.
Yeah.
It's like how we produce alcohol and other things like that. It's not a crazy amount so that it's going to interfere and we can't actually tell if GHB was in the system or not. It's very low levels. So they can usually say, hey, this person was drugged, or it's just because this body's been sitting here a while.
Yeah, absolutely. So like I said, with the fact that it's only 30 of them, it could be just that it was higher than what they
right.
would have figured.
Those 30 had yeah. more than average.
Yeah. So we definitely see a chain here. And this again, this was as of 2019. So this was 11 years after their initial findings, and they're still investigating it. They're obsessed with this, that there has to be something here. And this may not even include ones that aren't even connected and found, such as Brian Schaefer, who went missing in March 31st of 2006.
Very famous case.
Yes, he was last seen at the Ugly Tuna Saloon, went out partying with a bunch of friends, and he was... like, nobody knows how he left the bar that night. Like, nobody got him on camera leaving. None of his friends were able to discover him. So there's a lot of theories about how he even got out of that bar without anybody seeing it. And
he's
the thing,
still there.
Yeah, he must be because he's never been found.
Just drinking.
Yeah, but he's in the Columbus area. He was in Columbus, Ohio.
So he wasn't found in the water.
No, he was never found at all. But the
still
reason
missing.
That, yeah, he is still missing, but we do bring it up because he fits the victimology. Young, attractive, college-aged man who went drinking out with some friends and never was seen again. So there was some opposition to the smiley face killer theory. So obviously a lot of the local police didn't really want to buy into this, that there was some killer out there going from city to city, taking out young college-aged kids, men. So about this, Gannon said, I know that there was some homicide group that said we didn't know what we were talking about, but I never saw one piece of forensic evidence in the group to disprove us. All they did was take articles from the news media and link them together as a paper. Any kid in high school could write that paper. That's not a comprehensive paper. So basically, they didn't think that there was any legitimacy in this. They knew they had the facts. They were certain that this was connected. There had to be a connection here because there was just too much coincidence. However, in 2008, the FBI countered this notion with a statement, "We have not developed any evidence to support links between these tragic deaths or any evidence substantiating the theory that these deaths are a work of a serial killer or killers. The vast majority of these instances appear to be alcohol-related drownings." All right, so let's talk about the smiley faces just for a little bit. So basically, these were your typical smiley face. It was, you know, like what you'd see.
Like, have a nice day.
Yeah, have a nice day, smiley face. The part about this that I wasn't really sure of is how many of these were found during the investigation or how many were found once they started really investigating this later on. Because while this claims to have started in 1997, from what I understand, Gannon didn't really start working on this till the mid-2000s. And then they finally had enough in 2008 to release this whole press conference and have enough for the book later on. So this is what they They went to the sites, and they noticed that either in the places that the young men went, possibly went missing or would have went into the river, and also close by to where the bodies were discovered, like we discussed earlier, there would be a smiley face of some sort. The most sinister one of these was actually found in Iowa.
Okay, so can I just pause for a second?
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that these smiley faces were only discovered after the three gentlemen had decided there was a link between the cases. And then they found that the graffiti further linked or strengthened the link.
That's basically what it looks like. It looks like this is kind of the similarity they noticed along with some other pieces of graffiti. They actually found 12 other matching symbols similar to gang graffiti. So they believe that the smiley face killers were actually a bunch of different sects or cells, and this is how they would leave their mark on it. They've never really released any of the other graffiti. All they've told anybody is about is the smiley faces, then this is to protect their ongoing investigation. The detectives do say that the string of deaths could be the work of more than one killer because some of them took place on the same day in different states. And with the smiley faces...
It could be more than one killer.
It could be.
But it could be also the same guy at the same time everywhere.
No, I mean, it just could be happenstance at
that point. Coincidence. Accident. All those coincidences.
Yeah. So the most sinister smiley face was found in Iowa. This was drawn in red with the devil's horns on it. And next to the smiley face was a note that read, "Evil, happy, smiley face man."
Well, that's creepy.
It is very creepy. Now, as we talk about smiley face killers, I don't want anybody to get this confused with the very real happy face killer. So just as an aside to this, we're going to talk about Keith Hunter Jesperson, who was born April 6, 1955. He's a Canadian-American serial killer who is responsible for murdering at least 8 women in the United States during the early 1990s. He was called the Happy Face Killer in the media because he liked to draw smiley faces on his letters to the media and authorities. So his victim type was sex workers and transients who had literally no connection to him. He chose to do strangulation as his preferred method of murdering, which he performed as he killed animals as a small child.
So he really could not be further from these killers.
Yeah, absolutely. He's more like a washed up, low rate version of Jack
at this point. He just also liked to smile.
Yeah.
A lot.
So basically, just real quick, so after the body of his first victim, Tanja Bennett, was found, media attention surrounded Laverne Pavlinak, a woman who falsely confessed to having killed Bennett with the help of her abusive boyfriend, John Sosnovsky. Upset that he was not getting any media attention, Jesperson, the happy face guy, drew a smiley face on a bathroom wall hundreds of miles from the scene of the crime and wrote an anonymous letter confessing to Bennett's murder, providing proof. When that did not elicit a response, he began writing the letters.
Well, I wrote some graffiti on a bathroom wall. And the police didn't take it seriously. Did they even see it? Did anyone see it? Or did someone else just write, "John was here," over top of it?
He's such a
call drama. Mary for a good time.
He's such a drama queen. So anyway, that's enough about him. So we're up to 2008. So we have the 2008 killings. These obviously have not stopped from what we understand. We still have a seemingly an epidemic of young men who cannot stay out of the water while drunk. I mean, I guess maybe if we take away the drinking, we can see what happens to this to see if that number goes down. I mean, but I don't think anybody's going to agree with me on that one.
If each night we set loose on our city streets 50 to 100 toddlers and then counted how many of them ended up in the water, I mean, isn't it kind of the same as drunk dudes?
You've got a point there. So in December 2016, we have Dakota James, who he had a close call in December, but he was saved by a friend, Shelley. So he was coming out of a bar drunk, and he called his friend Shelly and was trying to figure out how to get home. And she offered to come pick him up. And he said, oh, there's this van across the street, and these people are waving me over. I should go see what's going on. Maybe they want to give me a ride. And
no.
Shelly managed to get there in time and picked him up, and Dakota was safe.
What year was this?
This was in 2016.
And how old was he?
He was about 21, 22.
So he grew up knowing about stranger danger, don't go to the van, and he was going to go to the damn van anyway?
He was. So Dakota and Shelly just kind of...
Shelly, bless your soul.
Yeah, Dakota and Shelly kind of just wiped this off, move on with their normal lives. Everything would have, you know, that would have just been, okay, a little bit weird thing to happen if it wasn't for the fact that Dakota went missing 5 weeks later.
No.
And then his body
was Shelly.
I guess she couldn't get to him that time.
Poor Shelly.
Dakota was discovered in March of 2017. So as of 2022, we know of 11 bodies, mostly men in their early 20s or 30s, who were removed from the Chicago River and Lake Michigan shoreline, according to the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office. This renewed the interest in the theory that there was a serial killer running around, or a group of serial killers. They were all targeting young men still across the Midwest. Out of these, three were dubbed as accidents, one was a suicide, and seven were undetermined.
So, undetermined. Okay. Tell me more.
Glad you asked. So, I did look this up because I was confused about what undetermined meant as well. This is when a drowning is unwitnessed, and evidence of an accident, suicide, or homicide are not present, then they have to rule it undetermined.
That makes sense.
Yeah. The difference in a lot of these later findings is that the bodies were found usually hours, not months later. So whereas the early ones seemed to be days, weeks, or months, these were kind of coming up right away. For example, Peter Salvino, he went missing in December 2022, and he was found just 3 days after going missing.
Where was that?
This is where we come into the theory, because... I kind of have my own theories for how this is. We're going to discuss that just a little bit here. But I want to discuss the theory in general. So they do discuss that these are groups of what they believe are people on the internet who use the internet to communicate and set up these smiley face deaths. It's a whole just elite network of people who have something against these specific types of young men that they need to go and punish them and hurt them. They believe that they have cells in all the major cities across the Midwest and possibly across the country, and that's why we see so many of these happening in different locations.
So are we talking like a dark web kind of thing, or like AOL message boards?
It could be just AOL message boards. I mean, it could be very apparent. And as you'll see, we'll go into this. This isn't something new to just this case or exclusive to this case. So Gannon said, we look at these young men as being the best of the best as far as we're concerned, talking about the victims. They're the best athletes, and all of them are affluent. They come from the best families. Anthony said years ago that these killers could have been envious or even jealous of the kids. They had something they didn't have. That's a possibility. But also, if you know anything about domestic terrorism, about these gangs in general, is that when you have nothing to lose. That's where terrorism actually begins. Gilbertson chimed in and said that there might be 12 in one cell, and that they go out one night and five of them do this. The next time, it's a different five. The way it should be conceived is that it's the cells that the serial killer part of it, not necessarily the individual. So very hive mind, this is my words, hive mind kind of mentality. Back to Gilbertson, because over time the individuals in the cell will evolve. Some will age out and just keep their mouth shut, because who wants to go to prison?
Not me, but I kind of want them to go to prison.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, but these are... They believe that they're smarter than everybody else, and that they're going to get away with this because now they're leaning on legend.
Yeah, but you know, that whole saying that three can keep a secret if two of them are dead is a saying for a reason. How many people can you really have keeping a secret?
Yeah, and that's a good, I guess, rebuttal to all this is how can there be this network of people and we're just ignoring it? The last quote I want to give on this, in this part of it is about the killers, and we'll go into kind of my theory on it. So Duarte, he says the type of person that would do this would be the opposite of them, of the victims. Not smart, someone not good in school, maybe doesn't have a job, and are not popular. Now, this sounds very familiar to me, based on a lot of things that we've seen in the last, probably since about 2009, 2010, in the last decade. We've seen the rise of the incel. Now, incels, or what they are short for, involuntary celibate, is a member of an online group. These typically have characteristics like misogyny and racism to the extreme.
The groups themselves?
The people.
Okay.
So the people, the person is called an incel, but they're the member of the group. And each individual member kind of just spouts the same kind of verbiage and hatred towards people of other races and specifically to women as well. They're unable, and the reason they do this is because they're unable to form romantic or sexual relationships with the people that they want to have.
Now, I know you said it's against other races, but it's not racially motivated. In most cases.
In most cases, no. It's okay. But we'll get into it.
It's more sexually motivated?
Yeah, it's more they try to go after the women that they feel have scorned them, or the men that they feel are taking the women. So we'll get into that.
Don't you take my women.
So this translates into a hate of those who are able to get into romantic or sexual relationships, where they will attack them both online and in person. So the American Southern Poverty Law Center described incels as part of an online male supremacist ecosystem, and it is included in their list of hate groups.
I need to take a shower just hearing that description.
It's they're horrible. They're very horrible people. So they're mostly white, heterosexual, and male. Incels, the term actually started being used in the 1990s. This was created, the term, which was actually incels, I-N-V-C-E-L, for involuntary celibate, and then shortened to incels later on. It was mostly the program, or the chats and websites, was a way to connect with others who were experiencing trouble with having relationships due to social awkwardness, marginalization, or mental illness. So basically, it was all genders. It was gender inclusive. It was actually started by a woman, and it wasn't supposed to be hate towards anybody who was getting it or anger at anybody who was not giving it. It was just a way for people who felt lonely or really awkward and they weren't able to form relationships, for a way for them to just be able to talk about their problems and have a safe place to do this.
You mean therapy?
Well, yeah, but it was the 90s and we were discovering computers, and so they would go online to these chat rooms and they would meet up with people and they would just share their frustrations.
Instead of going to therapy.
It's the 90s. I mean, what do you want me to say? I'm just giving you the facts. So this did change in the mid-2000s. It changed to be more about angry white men using the platform and terms to become way more hostily misogynistic. It was mostly due because there were a couple websites that were running in the mid-2000s. One of them was Incel Support, which was similar to the format of the 90s, where it was just gender inclusive. It was highly moderated to make sure there was no hate being spewed, that everybody was treating each other with respect, and that it was a good welcoming community as a way for support. Then there was the site loveshy.com, which was founded in 2003. This kind of became a hive for this new breed of incel.
And it sounds so innocent, like you're just going to have shy people matchmaking. But, no.
And, you know, it could have been, but it wasn't very moderated. So it tended to be where people could come in and kind of speak their minds a little more harshly and know, like, they could say extreme things or more extreme things and they wouldn't get in as much trouble. And then you had the extreme right-wing members of 4chan entering. And the incels of Loveshy merged with 4chan and they became just this new horrible group where they would push the boundaries of what you could talk about and really put down women and most everybody. It became a hate fest.
They sound so delightful.
Yeah.
I'm sure their mothers are so freaking proud.
Oh yeah, I'm absolutely that. Basically, it became cool to be edgy and horrible. It was the thing to do on the internet. Is you had this face of anonymity, and you would use it to spout all this hate. They moved on. Well, they didn't move on, I'll say. They were still on 4chan. The website kind of died down, but that's because Reddit was popping up. And there came a subreddit called rincels, which became the new home of the growing group. And this had even more extreme posts than what we'd seen on Love Shine Anywhere. Where
I have a question.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's the subreddit is incels.
Yeah.
So that's not like a name, like an insult that we call them. That's like what they labeled themselves.
No, they've labeled themselves from the 90s that they were involuntarily celibate. And they were the reason that they're celibate is because the world doesn't understand them. Whereas in the beginning, they were like, well, maybe there's something wrong with us and we need to kind of learn how to talk. These more modern age incels, the ones that merge with 4chan and go into Reddit, believe that they are being punished by society for being different. And they are involuntarily being told they have to stay celibate. And so they shorten this to give themselves this name.
The logic really reminds me of one of our former presidents of the United States.
Yeah, really. Some more extreme posts were found on the incels subreddit, and a lot of these even advocated for sexual harassment against women, where you could go there and brag about what you did. And it was encouraged and pushed to do more of these acts against women. This type of behavior was banned on Reddit in 2017, and they also banned the subreddit along with that. But unfortunately, grossness finds its way. And they just kept popping up in other subreddits.
I was going to say, couldn't they just reform in another group over and over again?
They basically did. And from what I understand now, the modern equivalent to it is Red Pill, where it's the, and I think it's also been shut down recently, but that used to be a big thing as well, where masculine white men would, you know, come together and, you know, say you need to take the red pill to be better than everybody else and stop living in the fake world set up by...
Oh, like the Matrix.
Yeah. So, so this so would have been cool. Bad enough, you know, if they had just stayed on the internet talking their ish to everybody.
Talking their internet.
If they had just stayed there, whatever, you know, we could block them, hide them away. But then came Elliot Rodger. On May 23rd, 2014, he killed 6 people and injured 14 others near the campus of the University of California, Santa Barbara. He blamed it on the fact that he just wasn't getting laid like he thought he would, and the college experience was dumb, and he should have had all the sex and all of the dates and everything, so he was just going to go start killing people. He mostly focused on women in his attack. But he did manage to kill some men and hurt some men because he was just going wild and doing this.
Let's go ham.
This wasn't the first of these types of incel killings that we saw, but this was the first that came with repercussions. He left behind a 137-page manifesto regarding his actions, which became a Bible for incel culture and a level for people to achieve.
Why did they give it to the people? Why didn't they keep it like a secret? Why are we making him famous?
Well, funny you should mention that. This is it reminded me of the 2002 thriller movie Spree.
That was a fun movie.
It was a fun movie, and the part that really scared me about it was how similar to how this type of incel mentality kind of comes. You know, with Elliot Rodger, he was doing it on purpose, but with...
Kurt.
With Kurt.
Kurt's world.
With Kurt, he wasn't intending to do it out of incel motivation. We don't know his motivations. He went on a spree killing because he was trying to get internet famous.
He just wanted to be loved.
But the same people, the incels, the right-wingers, the 4chan people, they took the video, which should not have ever come out, the video that the movie is actually found footage with, they released it to tell Kurt's story and say, hey, everybody be like Kurt. This is exactly what Elliot Rodger did. but intentionally.
You know what? That is such a good movie that I forgot that it was found footage, because you know I hate found footage.
I know. It was a really good movie. It's one of my favorite movies, honestly. I mean, if you guys have not watched it, it's a fun ride. It's a little gory. It's scary, but it's kind of a modern-day slasher. It has a lot of modern-day elements to it that really flip it on its head. You can tell it's a modern-day story.
And it's starring...
Joe Keery.
Okay. So, yeah, he's Kurt, and it's a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. But it does, while it doesn't mention incels specifically, I think because I just heard about one of the cases which happened in Canada, where a young man decided, because of Elliot Rodger, he even mentioned in his publications and in his online communication, he wanted to be like ER. And he went and ran down a whole bunch of people in Canada
because he couldn't
get a gun.
Like with a work van type thing, right?
So incel shooters typically go after women, or the men that the women would be interested, as I mentioned, who they nickname as Chads.
Well.
The women, I believe, are Beckys, and the men are Chads.
Becky with the good hair?
Yeah. According to the incel chat rooms, these are usually athletic, handsome, rich, sexually active men, and most often white, but some blame it on black men. And, you know, they use this as racism that, you know, black men are somehow inherently better than white men, and that's why white men are getting killed off in this imaginary war that these dumbasses have formed. Again, sounds like a very recent president of ours.
I was going to say that made me think of Get Out.
Oh, yeah. No, that's also the same. Yeah, it's racist. Even if you're saying another race is better than another race, it's still racist. You're still saying their race somehow makes them different. Just, let's not. So, arguably, this was the catalyst as well as the possible climax into the new world of murder and mayhem that we were seeing. Due to the timing of the creation of incels around the mid-90s, their victimology and their ability to think as a hive mind, because they all just say the same things on the internet. They just are parrots.
I was going to say, it's not a creation of incels. It's the organization and not accumulation. What is it when people get together?
A hive mind, a grouping.
A grouping, a meeting. A meeting.
Conference.
They had the incel conference.
Yeah.
I mean, they branded themselves, essentially,
yeah.
You know, in the 90s, because these type of people have obviously always existed, but they just sat at home and pouted alone, and then they got the internet, and they're like, hey.
Yeah. Yeah, so basically, because of this, they do fit the type that could create this cell of smiley face killers, even starting as early as 1997. These cells exist all over the country. As I said, ER was in the University of California. There was a bunch of incidents in California or in Canada. In 2009, an incel-related shooting happened in Philadelphia, the same city where there have been smiley face killings. Violent acts perpetrated by the scum have happened all over, from California to Florida to Texas, even all the way up into Canada. And while these are usually mass shootings and murders and spree killings, who's to say they can't also be working behind the scenes? Detective Gannon said that these cell members would communicate via online chat forums. They do know how these guys work, and it does seem to fit in.
But when there's literally thousands, how do you pick out the handful that are murderers?
Yeah. It's hard, but you don't know which ones are going to be spree killers as well.
Right.
And that group holds that capability.
But then that goes back to the whole, just because they're in that group, you can't assume they're going to commit a crime.
Yeah.
Wasn't that the whole Marvel Civil War 2?
Yeah, but
incels... Was that number
2? Yeah. But incels in general are considered a hate group and a terrorist group.
Right.
Because of all this stuff that happened. So I have two theories when it comes to these killings, or alleged killings, we'll say. So basically, first is that between 1997 and 2008, the crimes were all mostly unrelated. It could have been a possible serial killer that started this, and then it turned into copycat killings. So, you know, that we've seen that happen. Like, look at Jack the Ripper, look at a bunch of these other cases. As soon as one person does it, people need to copycat and do it. So if you do have somebody running around who killed You start with killing Patrick McNeil, you get a few other people in that, and then you stop, but somebody else is like, hey, I'm going to do the same thing. That's a pretty good crime. He got away with it. So we're going to keep joining up with, you know, and people are going to keep doing this. Then all of a sudden, you know, and in 2008, we get an announcement of, here's an official name group doing this. The other theory is that the 1997 to 2008 crimes were all the work of an early offset of the incel community, who they took out the men they deemed as Chads. Now, we don't know when they officially named these, because obviously it wasn't Chads at the time, and we don't know if there was a negative aspect to any of these chat rooms and forums. We're told it was, you know, by the creator, Elena, that this was supposed to be a place of peace and love, but obviously these scumbags were in that community from the beginning and were scumbags enough that as soon as they had forum to be gross, they started taking it.
Wait, so the group was created by a woman?
Yes.
And they took over?
Yeah. Because she stopped, like, talking about it because she found love. She was like, hey, this works for me. The smiley faces were worked in after the 2008 naming of the group, and then they were forever known as the Smiley Face Killers. So since then, I believe that from 2008 to now, the Smiley Face Killers have become a real entity because we made it that way. The Smiley Face Killers are a more subtle form of the latter spree killing incels that were becoming more prevalent because we started seeing incel shooters as early as 2009, which is shortly after this. As seen by their subtle presence in the 90s to their media presence in the 2010, incels were getting way more bold and open about their hatred. And as of 2023, Gannon Duarte have 681 cases in their database that could be connected.
That is bonkers.
Yes. And again, these are ones we don't know what connects them other than maybe victimology and graffiti found at the scenes.
Huh.
So we have 681. So, again, my theory here with this is we're going to get into the legend part of this, is that we are seeing a legend coming in real time. What may have never been connected has now been connected, and now we have a name that was given by the media, and that has exploded. Well, this may not have been the Smiley Face Killers initially, and they may not have even have been linked. There's a possibility that now the killings from 2008 on are intended to be smiley face killings.
Was the smiley face term actually coined by the media, or was that the investigators that wrote the drowning forensics?
That was the investigators. They named this the smiley face killings, and then it came into the media in that way. There's the 2008 press conference on the Today Show was the first time we had heard smiley face killers. Good Morning America. And so from there, and that's the thing, is now at this point, we don't know. We're always going to associate certain people's deaths with possibly being related to the Smiley Face Killers. The first one I even heard about was Brian Schaefer, and that was True Crime Garage, and they mentioned it in joking. And it's been on my mind since.
Well, the thing is, with a killer or systems of killer of this type, even if one is caught or dies or becomes inactive, it doesn't stop Smiley Face, because now Smiley Face is legend.
It is. And that's exactly where we're at. And legion. Yeah, that is exactly where we're at. We're not going to see the Smiley Face Killers die because it's officially legend now. There's a fictional movie about it. It was released in 2020, and it was inspired by the cases from this book, from this textbook.
So good.
We didn't even finish it, y'all.
So good.
Like, I'm sorry. It's boring. They did so much trying to pace out the movie for an hour and a half that they had 15 to 20 seconds of establishing shots in between people talking. But it basically follows a young college man who believes he's being followed. They had been reports of other drownings in the area, and the movie follows him being stalked and harassed by these people, and he is eventually caught and killed, and then they move on to their next victim.
So you assume, because we didn't actually finish
it. I read the synopsis.
Oh, cool.
I did, because cool. I couldn't finish it, but I needed to know before I reported on
it. I wish I cared that much.
But anyway, so there is a fictional movie about the Smiley Face Killers. There's also a real documentary that explores Gannon and Duarte and Gilbertson's work on the Smiley Face Killing. It's, I believe, The Hunt for Justice.
Well, you know, being a horror fan, of course, what I'm thinking this whole time is American Horror Story Cult. In that season, when they would go to kill people, the cult, they would spray paint smiley faces on the walls.
Oh, yeah.
And on the side of the houses, and that's kind of like was their call, and people who got the smiley face were afraid the killer was after them, and
yeah,
they had also a whole smiley face killer thing.
Okay. Yeah, I remember that now. So, you know, Brian Murphy definitely probably got that inspiration from these smiley face killings, because it was already well in the news by this point. Like, it had invaded. And so that's what we're looking at here, is that no matter what happens from this point on, it has officially been named that there's going to be smiley face killers for the rest of eternity. There's always going to be a speculation on any time we find a young college-aged man drowned in the river.
So, on the flip side of that, does that mean that, you know, any time that we see smiley face graffiti, we should be looking for a body?
I mean,
or running for the hills?
Would it be unsafe to do? I don't have a lot of evidence on how many of these actually have smiley faces, especially from the last 10, 15 years since the report's been done. There is a website that's kind of keeping up with the killers, but I don't, or with the killings and the victims, but I'm, again, not sure how many of these actually had smiley face killings, and we also don't know the other graffiti. But I would say, yeah, if you see a smiley face, maybe you could be the one to discover one of these young men after they've gone missing.
You yourself could also be the next victim.
I'm not. I do not fit the victimology anymore, and you don't either, so I guess we're okay. We're safe.
There's always a one-off,
bro. There always. Okay.
There's always a one-off. If you see a smiley face, run.
Yeah, just don't trust the smiley faces. We're just going to run with that.
Smiley faces kill you.
So this was quoted in the 2010 report from the Center for Homicide Research, and this was a huge case study pretty much debunking the smiley face killer theory. So in this report from the La Crosse, Wisconsin Police Department, they said, throughout history, society has always needed to produce monsters, often called folk devils, to help explain the unexplainable homicide and other forms of death then become mysteries. This information vacuum becomes a breeding ground of rumors, myths, legends, and all forms of monster making. And that's exactly what I always hope to continue exploring here with Fairy Tales, is how this work, I think, how this works. I think Smiley Face is a prime example of that. We are seeing something that wasn't there before, that got assigned to it, and now the legend is going to run rampant. We're seeing Jack the Ripper evolve in real time.
Bigfoot.
Bigfoot, yeah, exactly. It started with one sighting, and now it's just not going to stop anymore. So with that, we're going to end Fairy Tales. I'm going to get the Instagram set up. I'm going to get the website set up here soon. Hopefully, we're going to have the podcast hosted, as well as some of the transcripts of the stories and some interesting tidbits. We've got some projects that I'm looking forward to doing here in the next few months to dive a little bit deeper into this. Otherwise,
if you'd like a in-depth look at one of these cases, I'm actually covering the case of Jared Dion on Beautiful Places to Die, so check that out, and maybe it can help you formulate a better opinion on who you think Smiley might be.
Yeah, it's definitely a theory worth looking into. Other than that, you guys stay safe out there.